Welcome to Russian History Retold. Episode 290, an interview with the author of Haunted Empire, Gothic, and the Russian Imperial Uncanny.
Hey, today we have a special guest, Valeria Sobel, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's the author of Haunted Empire, Gothic, and the Russian Imperial Uncanny. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Sobel.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. It's an honor.
Thank you. In the podcast, we've covered a number of literary giants in Russian and Soviet history, like Chekhov, Tolstoy, Akhmatova, Solzhenitsyn, Pasternak, and Gorky, as well as the development of Russian literature. But your book takes this to a whole other level that I believe many of my listeners would be fascinated by. What intrigued me right away was two terms that are in the title of your book, Gothic and Uncanny. So what do you mean by them?
Yeah, thank you. So it's in different direction also, because I don't really deal with many giants. I look at a lot of minor figures, actually, in Russian and Ukrainian literary, or minor at least by, you know, by the standards of sort of canon. Yeah, so we can talk about it later, maybe. But in terms of Gothic and uncanny, so Gothic is, we're used to it more as an architectural term, right? But it was also a literary genre. So as an architectural term, right, we all know basically what it means, right? Cathedrals, right, of a medieval period, or neo-Gothic, pseudo-Gothic architecture of many college campuses, not Urbana-Champaign, but not the University of Illinois, but many others. But the term itself actually originates from the word Goth, which the Germanic tribe, right, that sacked Rome in fourth century Common Era. And the associations were particularly with this barbarism, right, kind of the that barbaric northern tribe attacks the cradle of southern, right, a sophisticated civilization and destroys it. So later, when this architecture was created in Middle Ages, and then the whole medieval culture was sort of dismissed by during the Renaissance, they termed it Gothic because it was whimsical, ornate, not harmonious, right, by the standards of, you know, classical antiquities that was resurrected during Renaissance. So it's actually had negative connotations and had like original association with that, as I said, barbarity, backwardness, irrationality. And then when in the 18th century, mostly in the British literary tradition, there was a series of novels that often set in Middle Ages and also invoke the kind of irrational fears, you know, ghosts, haunting castles. That term was resurrected and applied to that particular literature, both because of its primarily medieval setting or medieval castles, although it wasn't always medieval later on, but and also because of this whole complex of associations with all these values that were kind of not in line this time with Enlightenment values, right? So Gothic was, Gothic novels were about irrationality. Again, it was about some dark prejudices, some dark secrets, you know, the ghost of the past haunting the present, everything that challenged the kind of confident rationality of the Enlightenment era with its belief in reason and so on. And historians later, historians of literature have claimed, and I think justly so, that even though the first Gothic novels appeared before the French Revolution, but the true explosion of the genre happens in the aftermath of the French Revolution in the 1790s, mostly, and early 1800s, that the kind of crisis of Enlightenment and the sort of sense of the world falling apart, basically, that accompanied, right, the events of the French Revolution, the terror, the Napoleonic Wars, that the literary genre was at some level a response, artistic response to that sense of disorientation. So I can talk about the Russian context now or later, however we want, but that's the term. So, and this genre proved extremely popular. Probably everybody's familiar with Dracula, right? The novel hundreds years later, but it was still a very productive and active, vibrant tradition throughout the 19th century. Edgar Allan Poe, right? And so on. And in Russia, it came later, and it was kind of seen as a borrowed genre, as a kind of that fashion, you know, Russia was lagging behind, it was borrowing everything from the West, the Gothic literature was popular, so Russian writers were desperately trying to keep up and started writing their own Gothic stories, and this is the reason why Russian Gothic was not, for a long time, did not receive serious scholarly attention. So scholars kind of dismissed it. It's just another Western influence, not worth talking about. But I'm trying to show its importance. And then Kenny is kind of a related concept, because Gothic literature is a lot about fear and the sense of being in a kind of unsettled sense of, you know, you're in the castle, you think you're okay, but there are some steps in the hallway, and then, oh, there's a ghost there, or there was some crime or some transgression in the history of that family, right, that comes back and haunts you. And I look at it more from a from a historical kind of perspective, as those traumas or of history, of colonization, of imperial expansion that kind of come back and haunt Russian Empire in the 19th century. But the term uncanny I took from Freud unabashedly, who had this famous essay in 1919, Das Unheimlich, or the uncanny. And actually, if you're a linguistics nerd, anybody who's a linguistics nerd should look at this, or etymology nerd, look at this essay, even if you don't care about psychoanalysis, because the first part of the essay is a fascinating etymological linguistics kind of excursus, where Freud shows that, so unheimlich literally means unhomely in German, which I don't know so well, but I can figure this out. So it should be the opposite of homey, familiar, right? Comfortable, intimate. It's something scary, something foreign. But Freud says, if you go deeper into the etymology, you see that heimlich, homey, you know, one's own, domestic, also has an additional meaning of concealed from the outsider, something that's only accessible to the insider members of the home or the family. And in association with that, it develops the connotations of being mysterious, esoteric, unsettling, scary. So as a result, the uncanny, the unheimlich, and heimlich, the homey and unhomey, the familiar and strange, the comfortable, safe, and threatening kind of collapse into one, or sort of merge into one category. And this is, I thought it was fascinating, because to me, that's what I started seeing in literary texts about the Russian Empire as a metaphorical home, right? It's kind of the place where those literary characters, you know, they move around, they're Russians, or maybe not, but they're labeled as Russians in the imperial sense. They visit various regions, but especially I look at the borderlands, right? There is something unsettling about that place. And why so? So I'm trying to kind of, and of course, in literature, the Gothic mode with its emphasis on fear, on anxiety, right, on mystery, is a perfect literary vehicle for channeling the sense of disorientation, the uncanniness of the imperial experience. And that's what I try to kind of explore in my book, to bring those two modes together, to two themes together, the literary tradition of the Gothic as a, again, the artistic tool for expressing, through seemingly innocent, entertaining popular genre, expressing some deeper historical and national traumas.
Right. Yeah, the fascinating about that merger with you, and knowing so much about Russian history and how unsettled it was for pretty much its entirety of the thousands of years that it's been around. But what sparked your interest in this topic?
Yeah, interesting question. So it's a long story. I hope I won't digress too much, because actually, originally, this is was kind of a new development in my research agenda. My first book, which was based on my Columbia University dissertation, which also had a catchy title, Febris Erotica, Love Sickness in the Russian Literary Imagination, dealt with a complete, also with 19th century, but with, and also in a historical context, but with a completely different set of concerns. It was more about the interaction of medicine and literature, and this phenomenon, kind of a trope of love sickness, of heroes succumbing to physical illness as a result of some kind of romantic, unfortunate romantic experience, unrequited love, and how this reflected contemporary theories about the human soul, the emotions, the connection between the physical and the spiritual or emotional. So that was kind of a different story altogether. And I was never comfortable. I didn't used to be comfortable of writing on kind of politicized topics because I felt like I'd rather deal with literature, culture, maybe science, but nothing that ideological. But I was also fascinated by the portrayal of ethnic others in Russian literature and literature in general, of ethnographic elements in literature. I taught a course on travel literature, which of course involves a lot of encounter with different cultures or different regions and kind of the shock and the of seeing, you know, somebody who doesn't look like you, or doesn't sound like you, and what do you do with that? But it might come from a personal experience. Maybe I think that interest as a Soviet Jew growing up in Soviet Ukraine, and even though I spoke both Russian and Ukrainian with my friends, and kind of we all shared the same secular Soviet culture, I always had this acute sense of otherness as most other Soviet Jews. So I think that's part of the kind of the personal dimension of that interest. And then, it's actually, when I was teaching the travel course, I taught some of the works I've been reading, I've taught and read so many times before, but you kind of see differently when it's put in a different context. And I don't know if you had a podcast about Lermontov and his novel, A Hero of Our Time, which is set in the Caucasus. And portrays this Russian sort of Byronic hero, right, trying to escape the banality, right, of Central Russia in this colorful, dangerous world. But there is one interesting novella that constitutes the novel in the middle called Tamань, which is a little town, which is actually just across from the Crimea Peninsula east. And it's a first stop, chronologically, it's the first stop of that protagonist when he's going to the war in the Caucasus to join the Russian army. And when I taught it, not as a part of like 19th century romanticism or survey, but part of the travel course, I started zooming into the inter-ethnic encounters. And I noticed, okay, it's a Russian town. He even talks about it as a godforsaken, worst little, like ugly town in Russia. But the characters he encounters there speak Ukrainian, and things get really confusing. And it's a Cossack, actually, settlement, and that explains it. It's a dark atmosphere. It's a little mysterious house. The characters speak Russian to him, Ukrainian to him, but Russian to each other. One boy is blind, but he's suspiciously adroit and just runs around very well. The old woman is deaf, but maybe not. So, and it's not clear how these people are related. And that sense of disorientation at so many anthropological level, right? Language, kinship, even physical disabilities, right? Are constantly called into question in this novella. And our like Russian officer with all his bureaucratic documents, his travel permit, he's completely helpless and disoriented in that ambiguous space. And it's actually a frontier town. He's about to cross into the Caucasus. It's still Russia, which is trying to conquer the Caucasus. But that part is still part of the Russian Empire. But actually, that was the most dangerous place for him in the whole novel. He experienced some very problematic adventures and was pretty safe during the war in the Caucasus. So I thought it was an interesting paradox, and I started investigating further. And that is truly uncanny situation there, because that, again, sense of the certainty, sense of being at home in Russia, but not really at home anymore. And the Gothic trappings of the novella was this dark house and the sort of subhuman strange creatures bordering on the supernatural, even though there's no supernatural element per se. That kind of inspired me to pursue this theme further and look at other possible texts and their context and bring it into more coherent narrative.
Fascinating. One thing I found really interesting is how you differentiated Russian expansion and their empire and say the one the British had, where they not only expanded on their own island to, you know, Wales and Scotland, but into their, quote, exotic overseas colonies.
Yeah.
Do you care to comment to that?
Yes, of course. So, yeah, it's sort of, most historians talk about the Russian Empire as a land empire, right? Which is not completely unique, like Austro-Hungarian Empire, right, is also land empire. But it's quite different, say, from the British case, where indeed, like, there was India, right? There were some islands overseas. So there's more of a kind of tangible distance between the metropolis, in the colony, between that white British kind of care of civilization, right, so to speak, that was a justification, right, and the colonized, who often had different skin color, right, and completely different language. And the Russian Empire, it's much vaguer, right? So, okay, if you go to the Caucasus, it's quite different in terms of, you know, the religion, the ethnicity, and so on. But if you go to the Baltic regions, it's also different, but it's a very difference, right? And also, if you go to Ukraine, it's all the whole story, different story. These are Slavs, right, who look like you, who speak a similar language. So then how do you draw these differences? How do you establish your superiority? How do you establish your dominance? And there are books, you know, tons of books, mainly by historians, but some literary scholars as well, written about this. And some actually say that it's not such a unique experience. Some say it's very unique. I'm not a big fan of, like, exceptionality of the narrative of Russia's exceptionality, but I think there is some interesting particularities here. So, and what Russia did in those situations, so it's very easy, right, to show how we're different for the British, to show how we're different from the Indians, right? But it's harder for Russians to say how we're different from or superior to, say, Livonians, as they call the Baltic population, right? Or the Baltic territories at the time, because they're white. They actually were under Sweden at the time. They were multilingual, and or the Finland even, right? That every Russian, I have a whole chapter on Finland. Almost every Russian traveler, right, comments on how well-educated and literate Finnish peasantry was. They all read their Bible, the Lutherans, right, in German, while Russian peasantry was primarily illiterate. And yet, this was the factual kind of documentary observation. Once you get into literature, you see those mythological portrayals of the wild Finn sitting amidst the cliff, completely mythologized, separated from civilization, having no history, in tune with nature, wizard, complete disconnect. But this kind of mythologization, and that's not the only reason, but the big reason was that justifies, right? They need to be saved. They need to be civilized. They need to be brought into history, right? And who does it better than we, the glorious Russian Empire, right? So that was one strategy, for example. Or with the Baltics, the story said, look, they don't talk about the contemporary, or very little about the contemporary situation. They talk about the medieval past and the German Teutonic Livonian order there. And they portrayed completely in very gory Gothic terms as this rule of tyranny, of completely whimsical cruelty, and basically barbaric medieval bloodthirsty German barons who sort of ruled over this unfortunate land that again kind of is brought into a benevolent rule by the Russian Empire. So it's fascinating, actually, how history is artistically and ideologically manipulated to both make it an interesting, you know, terrain for exploring new literary techniques or themes, but also for justifying the colonial rule.
Yeah, fascinating. You divided the book into two parts, yeah, North and South, with Finland and the Baltics in the northern part, and Europe, mm-hmm, and the southern one. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So to be perfectly honest, the first motivation behind this decision was purely structural and kind of convenience, but also thematic, because this is how the British Gothic operates. So it kind of... The idea is that in an opposition to the earlier, right, ancient sort of thinking, when the Norse was associated with barbarism, with that Gothic tribe, right, that attacks the developed civilized South, right, the Roman Empire. In the Enlightenment period, things are reversed, right? Now, British Empire, right, Britain feels itself being the kind of that rational Protestant northern power that overcame those pitfalls and prejudices of medieval barbarism. And they displace this medieval sensibility, even if work takes place still in the 18th century in their time period, they displace it geographically into the South. And what is the South? Southern Spain, Italy, Southern France. If you look at Gothic novels produced by English, British writers, by Radcliffe, by Matthew Lewis, by Maturin, they're all set in, well, there's sometimes, they start in Ireland, which is also interesting, but usually there's some movement towards Southern France or Spain or Italy. And why so? Because this were Catholic countries that are seen as this epitomes of, that still preserve this barbarity, that the darkness, that irrationality that the Protestant North has successfully overcome. So this is the British case. And I'm thinking, okay, but let's look how it works in Russia, because it's a very different situation, right? The whole Protestant Catholic opposition is not relevant. And also, I was a bit tired, to be honest, of the East-West, this current narrative about Russia between East and West, you know, Asia, Europe, where does Russia belong? It's all relevant. These are good questions. But this, I was thinking, but North and South is also a productive axis. So what if we look there, especially since the Gothic genre tends to play with that division? So, and actually, it was still quite vibrant, that opposition, especially in the first half of the 19th century. There was still the strong association of Russia with the North, with a kind of vigorous, younger culture. And especially also because one of the foundational Russian narratives come from this idea of Varangian or Viking, invitation, that it's a legend still, not fully proven, but the narrative goes that in early medieval times, there was a mess in the medieval East Slavic lands, and they invited Varangians or Vikings to rule over them. So there is this kind of intimate connection to the North at the very foundation of what later became the Russian state. And this is, by the way, what they play with a lot in those Baltic tales of the 19th century. Yeah, they were German, they were Swedish, but they really, originally, it's all our territories. We were there. We had a strong connection to this areas and so on. So this is the North. And the South, I decided to do something a little different. Usually, people think of the Russian South as the Caucasus or Crimea, something more exotic, truly all the way, by the Black Sea and so on. And I decided to choose Ukraine, well, partly because I'm from Ukraine. I really wanted to bring that theme into my research, but it's not just random. Ukraine was consistently referred to in the 19th century Southern Russia. That was the idea, that this is kind of Russia's Southern double or Southern variation. It was, the term was used by Gogol, by Ukrainian historians, by Russian historians, also Little Russia, but often Southern Russia. So, and it's also intimately connected, like the Scandinavian or Baltic North, to the narratives of origin, because, of course, Kievan Rus, that was the first East Slavic state, and later the Russian Empire, and still, unfortunately, claims its lineage, through Kievan Rus, where Orthodox Christianity was introduced, and so on. So these are two interesting regions, but that are both intimately connected to this very primeval, foundational stories of what Russia has become. But they also were only recently added to the Russian Empire at the time when my writers were writing. So Finland, for example, it was gradual between the early 18th and 19th century, it became part of Russia. The Baltics, too, the result of Sweden wars. And Ukraine and Kiev was gradually also incorporated into the Russian Empire, the result of various divisions of Poland and so on. So they still preserved an aura of exoticism and novelty, but at the same time, we're seen as part of our own heritage, which added that uncanny, confusing element, I think, to how they're portrayed.
Yeah, I always found it very interesting how, especially the current administration in Russia is saying that, Ukraine is Russian. It's not their own people. But when we look at it historically, no, they are their own people. They have their own history. When Moscow was still a little bunch of huts, in a forest, Kyiv was one of the most populated cities in Europe, greater than Paris, whose children of the leaders in the Veliky Knyaz were married to the king of France and to Scandinavia. Yeah. And I've had a discussion with the podcasters doing the history of the Vikings, and talking about how that influence came from the north and how that changed Russia. And there's all this ongoing argument between all the historians of, are they a Viking people? Are they a Slavic people?
Yeah.
But each one is a very different group of people from whatever parts of the Russian and Soviet empire. So I think you're breaking that up into that shows that there's a uniqueness in each one of these civilizations and peoples and countries, that they are separate and they're not just one empire that should remain together, especially when you look at Finland. And when they tried the Russification under Nicholas I, Alexander III tried so desperately to Russify everybody, but eventually failed.
Yeah.
And then you have Stalin, who would then, tear people from their home countries, like in Crimea, and send them to Siberia, and the mass change that he...
And attacked Finland, right?
And attacked Finland with very little success at first, I might add. He didn't work rather poorly. But that comes to the hard copy of your book came out in 2020. How have the recent developments in the region and above all the Russian war in Ukraine changed the way you see your book project now?
Thank you. So I started this project actually back in 2012. I was spending a sabbatical in Kyiv, my native city. And first I thought it was just going to be about Ukraine. And then I decided to add the northern element and kind of grew into broader project. But of course, it was still a relatively, there was some anxiety about like Russian influence in Ukraine, but it was still very far from the full scale war we have now. So I had no expectation that my project will have some immediate historical political relevance, because it's about 19th century and the representation of empire that's long gone, right? Well, not so gone as it turns out. So, and as I was working, then the events of 2013 and 14 unfolded was the Maidan Revolution, the annexation of Crimea, the war in Donbass. So I, even though, as I said, I was always a bit uncomfortable, had been about making my literature research connected to politics, I just had to say it. I put it into the conclusion of my book, which I submitted the manuscript in 2019, that as I was working this project, something truly uncanny happened, that Russian intervention in Ukraine, and it was before the full-scale invasion, right? And I kind of noticed how the same narratives, the same rhetoric is coming back, not only the nightmarish kind of uncanny quality of the conflict, but also this idea that Ukraine is this chaotic, dark land that needs to be put in order. Look at the Maidan, very similar to what Russians were how they were perceiving, like Cossackdom, for example. The Cossacks, how it was crazy, wild, uncivilized gangsters, right? Without them, being included into the Russian Empire and the imperial order, things would not have been well there at all. Just as one example. And then submitted the manuscript, right, still 2019. I'm thinking like, wow, this is going to be dated so quickly. Because I had really no idea what was coming next. And then, 22 comes and we'll wake up to this horror, or rather it was the evening here, right? When the shelling of Kyiv started overnight here, early morning for them. And suddenly, and the book I wouldn't want it to be relevant at this cost, of course, and by no means, but it has proven that this doesn't go away. And in the press, we've seen, right, so many references to, like, Putin still operates within the 18th century, 19th century imperial framework, right? This is something I worked on, and then it's proven to be coming back. Again, not just politically, but it's because I'm a literature scholar, right? So I work at the text of how you describe it, how you verbalize it, right? Even the rhetoric, the discourse, right, is still the kind of, let's say, the imperial imagination. Let's put it this, the imperial imagination that I'm trying to unravel and kind of describe in this book and analyze is still very much at work. Even Putin said, he compared himself to Peter the Great, right? And said, like, we are returning, we are not conquering. He mentioned Finland and the Baltics, actually, in the context of the Ukrainian war. We're just returning the lands that belong to us historically, the manipulation of history, right? We see a lot of that in that literature of the period, of course, in a more benign way, right, under the veneer of just an entertaining adventure narrative or gothic narrative, but it's still there. So, yeah, unfortunately, the book has acquired renewed relevance, which I didn't want and didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very similar to what I'm working on. I finished a book, and it was initially called Understanding Putin. But then I thought, no, that's not right. It's Understanding Russia. And it's, mm-hmm. and I had to change quite mm-hmm. a bit of it. Oh, I was trying to get it out about 3 years ago. And something just made me stop and say, something's going backwards. It's going back to a different time, especially with the annexation of Crimea, the Donbass issues. I was very skeptical that it wasn't going to expand. And I was asked, do you think that Putin would actually invade Ukraine? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes and no. Yes, mm-hmm. because he has it in his mind that this is a Russian empire that he wants to go back to. And I think he wants to go back to the Soviet era, where they had even a larger empire. And, you know, with Poland and all sorts of behind the wall. Mm-hmm. And I had to just think about this. And the literature is where I found solace, you might say, that my idea is that, yes, he will invade, even though it's not a smart move. And I don't think he has the ability to take over again. But it was in the literature. And Lermontov is one of those that I covered in the development of Russian literature. Now I think I have my book a little bit better situated. We're trying mm-hmm. to understand the Russian mindset. And it's not just Putin. It's many of the others within Russia itself and their mm-hmm. belief that they should take over. And I've been in contact with a number of Russians who have both sides. The ones who don't believe in Putin have been very careful about it. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. the others who still are there are saying, well, this is our land. So I see it in the literature of so many of the... I don't want to call them minor authors because they're just mm-hmm. as important as the giants, as I put them.
Yeah.
So there are so many. And I think that's one of the things I'm going to be exploring in the next year or so. I really want to thank you, Professor Sobel, for spending time with us and sharing your passion in Slavic literature. For me, it's more than just Russian because my mother was born and raised in Yugoslavia. She was, you know, all through the Slavic eras. And
of course,
I remind everybody to go to the Cornell University Press website. That's going to be on any of the podcatchers. You'll be able to find it in the description. And look for the book, Haunted Empire, Gothic and the Russian Imperial Uncanny. I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It was my pleasure to talk about this project, which, as I said, has unfortunately some connection to the present political developments.
And to my listeners, until next time, до свидания и спасибо за внимание. Where is stop recording? There we go.